Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, wow, we've had some welcome rain earlier this week, and it's been followed by blue skies, thankfully with no smoky haze, at least for the day I'm putting this show together. This show will first be broadcast on September 22nd, which is the autumnal equinox. So happy fall, everyone. We made it. Well, there are a couple new Desert Oracle episodes out there in podcast land, but so far they have not been made available to community radio stations. So while we wait, this week I'm bringing you an episode from October 2nd, 2020. Ken calls it, "In the Beginning Was Gaia." Then stay tuned for the second part of our show, when you'll hear about pupfish in the desert, and then we dive into the topic of endangered or threatened aquatic species right here in Montana. But for now...
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The desert in October. Libra time. The scales of justice blind to wealth and power. As time goes on, my time anyway, I find that every little hint of the natural living world is overwhelmingly beautiful. Especially this year. I cannot work outside for long because I just wind up watching the birds. And that smallest, smartest part of me, that smallest, smartest part of all of us, the voice of wisdom we usually drown out with podcasts and explainers and screaming at each other, whispers, you know? The whole point was to watch the roadrunners and the hummingbirds and the lizards doing push-ups on the patio. And of course, it's right, it's always right. And maybe I'll argue a little bit and say, well, Christ, I'm trying, it's not exactly easy, and there is work that has to be done, and at least the aim is noble, even if most of the work right now is mentally and spiritually exhausting. And as that's usually enough to shut off the connection, lose the signal, well then I shuffle back inside where I'll be distracted less by the birds and the breeze and the bunnies. Back to work, you miserable layabout. Back to the grindstone. Make more radio shows, more books, more magazines, more merchandise. And don't forget to have computer failures, network issues, office supply shortages, missing freight deliveries, post office problems, missed voicemails. Oh, don't forget about that. and make sure to send in your quarterly tax payment. And make sure the check doesn't bounce. Who do you think you are, anyway? A news story has been going around about how we've managed to do away with two-thirds of the wild creatures over these past traumatic 50 years. Good work, everybody. We push the animals into extinction as fast as we can, but every now and then an animal survives long enough to throw a virus back at us. As in the case of the COVID, the coronavirus. As in the case of AIDS and Ebola before. But evolution is an interesting machine because it has its own intelligence. And it plays the long game. Evolution is just what we call the little bit of the process that is visible to us. With our limited vision, our very limited time. About 15 or 20 years back, there was a handful of glory hounds making a commotion about how much they knew about evolution because they'd gone to college somewhere for a few years and were born wealthy and connected enough to know how to get book deals in their 20s. These were the atheist men. Very loud and bitchy men who were here to tell you, you dummy, that they knew everything. Imagine being a professional Western intellectual in this time of absolutely collapsing ecosystems and daily environmental disasters and mass extinction events and announcing that you had figured it all out, the life systems on this planet. You had looked out over our dying world and you nodded sagely and said, "This is good. For we have broken the shackles of the old demon-haunted world. The old world of spirits and gods and visions and meaning and purpose. When the forests were filled with creatures that sustained us. When we managed to exist without COVID-plagued corporate slaughterhouses filled with migrant workers whose wives are dragged screaming into border camp operating rooms, whose children literally vanish from the former Walmarts where they had been kept in squalid cages by your government." As James Lovelock says, and here I mean the scientist and ecologist who introduced the Gaia theory, G-A-I-A, the word at the root of all of our Earth words, geography, geology, because in the beginning was the word. And the word was with Gaia. For the word was Gaia. As James Lovelock recently told the Guardian newspaper, "We have created the conditions in which viruses will thrive, in which pandemics will wreak havoc. or to quote him from The Guardian, on the eve of his 100th and first birthday, you are not going to get a new species flourishing unless it has a food supply. In a sense, that is what we are becoming. We are the food. I could easily make you a model and demonstrate that as the human population on the planet grew larger and larger, the probability of a virus evolving that would cut back the population is quite marked. We're not exactly a desirable animal to let loose in unlimited numbers on the planet. Lovelock really reintroduced the Gaia theory, along with evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis. Gaia is Old Greek, Ancient Greek. Some people say it Gaia. It's probably from a pre-Indo-European tongue. It means the earth personified, the land and waters itself, named for Mother Earth, the goddess who embodies our planet. Because James Lovelock, 50 years ago, looked at the cold, dead industrial science all around him and looked at the world sinking into environmental catastrophe and realized, oh no, oh no. It's all alive, and the people do not see it. We think we are individual humans, but we are connected. We're connected life forms filled with millions of different living parts, bacteria and fungus and tiny insects eating the crust off our eyelids, etc. We exist only when the balance of oxygen, fresh water, sunlight, plants, animals, large and small, geologic stability, asteroid activity, lunar cycles, solar storms, and everything else are just right. When any of that goes out of line for too long, well, Gaia, the lone god, goddess, who decides if you live or die, my brothers and sisters, well, she just hits the big red reset button. Gaia is patient, but Gaia is not kind. She is what she is. And we have failed. We have failed our elders, we have failed our children, and we failed ourselves. Remember when the pandemic shut down much of the world during the first half of this outrageous year? What happened almost immediately? The animals came out of hiding, came out of their tiny reserves of park and forest and mountain peak. Sea creatures returned to tidal basins and river deltas once the toxic activities of the humans paused. But nature was not healing. Nature was just getting a look around at the rest of the world that pushed it away, punished it, killed most of it with unending abuse and horror. I wonder how many of those wild animals who made it onto Instagram because they wandered down a quiet main street in some once busy tourist town in the forest or the desert. I wonder how many of them wound up being burnt alive in the summer of infernos that followed. I wonder how many bears and bobcats and bighorn and birds died in the inferno, started by the gender reveal photo shoot in Oak Glen. Listening to Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. Let's do it. Let's open up the Desert Oracle mailbag. Let's see, this has, the Juicy Jitters on the front. I think this is a brand of cactus candy. Dear Desert Oracle, thanks for all the strangeness. I'm here in Cuba, New Mexico. A tiny little town, but a good one. Thank goodness we have our own constant source of weird. Love listening to the podcast. First read your pocket journal a few years ago, and my friend's Lou up in Whitewater Preserve. She's a rad lady. Glad I found you through her. Thanks for keeping desert people connected. All the best, Haley. Thank you, Haley. Or Holly. Haley. It must be Haley. Loo means toilet or outhouse in British English. For those of you wondering. For those of you who don't get out much. Here's a postcard that says, on a road sign, possible sinkhole ahead, but possible is X'd out. It's from the Center for Land Use Interpretation, sent by our friend Jack Freer, who says, the center checks in with a cryptic message of the future. Keep your head down and stay safe. Always, Jack, always. We try, anyway. Now, this here is a vintage postcard. And the print on the back is so faded, I don't even know what it's supposed to be. It looks like a building in the desert. And it's talking about driving back to somewhere from somewhere for the weekend. The air thick with smoke, the sun casting an ominous light, and temperatures well into the triple digits. Perhaps end times? Hopefully the end of something come November. Until then, I hope your swamp cooler and night hikes are helping you maintain sanity. Peace, love, burritos, and Oumuamua. From Ted T. Thank you, Ted. Remember Oumuamua? It was the strange, unknown object. It wasn't a comet. It wasn't an asteroid. It might have been a cylinder. Visited us a few years ago and turned around and took off. From Jeff, we have a postcard. Oh, of the beautiful Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias in Yosemite National Park. One of the old Works Progress Administration posters. Beautiful to look at. Good, honest, meaningful work for artists, graphic designers, printmakers. Back in our last major national collapse. It's from Jeff, who writes, "How serious are you about the Holy Rangers?" Serious as a heart attack, Jeff. Which I'm going to have if I don't get the hell out of the office soon. Another beautiful WPA art card. Ranger Naturalist Service, Yosemite National Park. By the artist C. Don Powell. "Dear Desert Oracle, on a recent drive to Yosemite," pictured on the opposite side, "I was listening to your Manson and Death Valley episode. At the exact moment you said that he was incarcerated just north of Bakersfield, I was in fact just north of Bakersfield. Exactly where I was supposed to be. Carry on. Jeff." Wait a minute, these are from the same Jeff, aren't they? I read them in the wrong order. Or maybe the right order. Oh, here we go. This is a picture postcard from Iceland. Okay, Ken, you're the media guy. The USA is in collapse and it's 127 degrees in Death Valley. How do we get Icelandic girlfriends? I await your plan. Mike Switzer." Mike, that was your job. Here we have a small envelope with a card inside, which says, "When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe." That's right. "Dear Desert Oracle, I hope you are doing as well as one can these days. Though I write from New England, and about as far as one can be from a desert in America, your podcast has continually inspired me." Thank you. This is from Ben Bosworth. And he says, "Around this time of year, I would typically be planning some sort of trip to check out some sort of interesting place around our country. However, the presence of everything makes that not an option. I'm left with a feeling often known as wanderlust. So he asks if I have any suggestions for film, TV, books, music, podcasts that does well to capture the spirit." No. None of those things capture the spirit. But you live in a beautiful place. Wilderness is wilderness, and you've got a lot of it back there. The Granite State, etc. Which state is that? So get out and enjoy the wilderness that's in your area, because that's your home. And come back and see us when you can. It's a typewritten letter. I love a typewritten letter. "Dear Voice of the Desert, we picked up the latest issue of Desert Oracle at the station in Joshua Tree back in June." Hey, you know what? The station just got a couple of boxes of our new issue. A little interjection from your editor here. if you're looking for issue 9, which is out now. Upon returning home, we became enamored with the Desert Oracle world. Enamored is how we tend to say it here. Whenever you say anything on the radio, somebody is gonna correct you eventually. So I did it myself. Thank you for being a proponent of all things deserty and strange. Please find and close to check for 1 annual subscription. Thank you. One more postcard in this batch. Hey, if you want to send us something, first, we appreciate your patience. I try to acknowledge anything that comes in, but I am several months behind. But I do appreciate it. And in one way or another, perhaps psychically, you will hear back. Maybe. Here we have a skeleton cowboy playing guitar on a chair next to a cactus. Congrats on the 100th show. Looking forward to Friday's live event at Pappy's. Patrick in Los Angeles. Thank you, Patrick. Of course, that event did not take place. I don't know if there will ever be such a thing, you know? I'm trying to come up with another way to get out and about and see people, and it's probably not going to be through the old ticketed nightclub process, which is gone for now. Maybe we don't need a corporate ticketed nightclub process to gather together at the river in the desert. This is Desert Oracle Radio. We broadcast Friday nights from KCDZ 107.7 FM in downtown Joshua Tree. Like I said, our new issue is out, and boy, my brain is a little fried. The whole truck of issues disappeared for 10 days. I was telling my musical collaborator, Red Blue Black Silver, who does almost all of the soundscapes you hear on this show, excluding this little bit of guitar theme at the end. Well, I was telling RBBS, I've never called him that in my life. I was telling him how sometimes the hardest part of the whole magazine situation is getting the finished magazine to where it's supposed to go, to the subscribers, to the stores, etc., etc. So we're very glad it's out. Hopefully it has reached you by now if you're a subscriber. We'll be back on the radio and in podcast form next Friday night, 10 p.m. Thank you for listening. Be careful out there if you're exploring the desert. It's still mighty hot. And good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Last April, my son and I visited Devil's Hole in Death Valley National Park, and we got to see the resident devil's hole pupfish that only live in that place. Here's some news that was released on April 24th this year. Amargosa Valley, Nevada. Agency biologists are excited to report increased numbers of one of the world's rarest fishes. Scientists counted 191 devil's hole pupfish, which is the most fish observed during annual spring season counts in 25 years. This is good news for the critically endangered fish living in Death Valley National Park. Devil's hole pupfish live in the smallest habitat of any vertebrate species on the planet. The Devil's Hole is a deep water-filled cavern located near Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge in Nye County, Nevada. The fish live in the upper 80 feet of the cave and depend on the 11-foot by 16-foot sunlit shallow shelf at the cavern's entrance for food and spawning. The remnants of Hurricane Hillary affected Devil's Hole in August 2023. Flooding can have negative effects on the fish in the short term. However, Hillary mostly benefited the fish's ecosystem by adding nutrients that washed off the surrounding land surface in a fine layer of clay and silt. Devil's Hole pupfish are counted every spring and fall using standard protocols. This year's spring count was done April 6th and 7th. Scientists used scuba to dive as deep as 100 feet to count fish. At the same time, other scientists count fish on the shallow shelf at the water's surface. Before the mid-1990s, scientists counted about 200 to 250 devil's hole pupfish each spring. For about 20 years, the population dropped to an average of around 90 fish, with an all-time low of 35 fish in 2013. Population counts in recent years have been higher. 191 observable pupfish were counted in April 2024, which is the highest spring count recorded since March 1999. Michael Schwem, senior fish biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, states, "It's exciting to see an increasing trend, especially in this highly variable population. Increasing numbers allow the managing agencies to consider research that may not have been possible in the past, when even slight perturbations of habitat or fish had to be completely avoided. We're excited about the future directions with respect to managing this species." A return to higher numbers of pupfish this time of year could signal important changes in the ecosystem. Kevin Wilson, aquatic ecologist for Death Valley National Park, states, "Recent high spring and fall counts show the importance of maintaining long-term data as we work to find out what's changed." Brandon Sanger, supervising fisheries biologist for the Nevada Department of Wildlife, has been conducting scuba counts at Devil's Hole since 2014 and noted, "It was really encouraging to see such a large number of young fish during these spring dives. Conditions within Devil's Hole looked healthy, so we have hopes of high recruitment over the coming months that will lead to a large population in the fall." Other biologists on site noted, "Fish appeared in remarkable condition and were very active. Many courting and spawning pairs of pupfish were seen during the count." Devil's Hole pupfish are jointly managed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Nevada Department of Wildlife, and National Park Service staff. The next pupfish count occurs in fall 2024. Well, all this had me asking, what aquatic life is rare or threatened here in Montana? Well, Montana FWP Native Species Coordinator Zach Shattuck was kind enough to answer some of my questions. Can you give me your name and your job title?
You bet. So my name is Zach Shattuck. I'm a native species coordinator for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And I work out of the headquarters office here in Helena, Montana.
Cool beans. Thank you. And last April, I got to talk with the Death Valley National Park fish biologist at Devil's Hole. And we talked about the pupfish. And I wondered, is there any species, whether they're fish or some other aquatic species, since you cover that too, native to the Montana region that are rare or endangered? Can you tell me, do you have a list of them?
Yeah, you bet. So, and that's something that people sometimes forget about, that aquatic species doesn't necessarily mean just fish. I am a big fish nerd, so I'll probably focus on fish species, but I will tell you about some of the, at least kind of federally listed species that we have here in Montana in the aquatic world. And I'll kind of start with the two insects. These are the newest, species to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. These are two species of stonefly that are found in really specific habitats up in like the Bob Marshall Wilderness and Glacier National Park, and then down in the Absorkey Beartooth Wilderness area. So those are meltwater Lednian and then Western Glacier Stonefly, and both those are threatened species. And unfortunately, we don't do much with them. Where they're found is very, very specific and is kind of out of the jurisdiction of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And those are two species kind of listed in a monumental way, in that they are sort of climate change refugees, that they are really being listed under kind of threats of climate change and receding glaciers in Glacier National Park, and are found really only in, kind of the meltwater areas of these receding glaciers. Moving on to fish, though, we've got three species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, and that's bull trout, which are threatened. Those are a type of salmonid, a trout or a char, on the kind of western side of the divide in Montana. And then we've got Kootenai River white sturgeon, which is a sort of a disjunct population of white sturgeon, only found, kind of in this most upper reach of the Columbia there in the Kootenai River. And then finally, we have pallid sturgeon, which is a fish species that I work quite a bit on with our biologists out in eastern Montana. Both these sturgeon species are listed as endangered. And they are incredibly interesting critters and pretty rare.
Could you say more about one of those species?
You bet.
It could be your favorite or one that you identify as of particular importance right now.
So if you ask anybody that knows me, I have a hard time nailing down a favorite fish species. It changes day to day. It's hard to play favorites. I will say I got one that we can talk about one that we listed above. But I did want to give kind of a shout out to a few fish that really love, and that would be, blue sucker, which I feel like is the fish biologist fish, and then sturgeon chub and sicklefin chub, which happen to be, two of my favorites. They're just little minnows that are found in these really big rivers of like the Missouri and the Yellowstone, and they just happen to be sort of favorite food items for pallid sturgeon, which is the species we'll kind of focus on. And I think, and I will say, just being in Montana, there is a lot to be, I think, thankful for, in that we've got some incredible freshwater fish diversity, and that kind of lends just to being at the crown of the continent. And so we've got fish species that, have evolved in like the Saskatchewan River drainage, and we've got some unique fish that we find up there kind of at the very top of the state. And then we've got fish species that, derived from the Columbia River Basin. And then we've got all these really cool critters that have come up from Missouri and the Mississippi River Basin. And that brings us to pallid sturgeon.
Okay. And how would you identify that? To people like me, that I'm not a fish biologist, but what would I look for if I'm trying to identify that, or just wondering, is this what I'm looking at?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple species that maybe you could kind of lump as being somewhat similar looking. But outside of these three species, really, there's just nothing else in the river that looks like them. So, we can kind of grossly lump paddlefish, shovelnose sturgeon, and pallid sturgeon. And between the two sturgeon species and paddlefish, there's quite a few differences. But really, what kind of makes these three, group and look similar is just they are super ancestral. These are some of the kind of oldest forms of fish that we have in Montana. And these are fish species that have, kind of evolved to their current form, somewhere late in the Cretaceous period. And the two sturgeon species that we have look very different from a paddlefish, though. A paddlefish has this big, long, people call them spoonbills, and that is the rostrum that people are kind of referring to. This is a big structure kind of in on their snout that helps them to forage for zooplankton. Similarly, with pallid sturgeon and shovelnose sturgeon, they've got this, kind of shovel spade-like nose, which, again, this is their rostrum, full of a little electrosensory organs, and these guys are kind of like a metal detector on the bottom of the river. They're benthically oriented. They live on the bottom. And so they've got this little metal detector, and it's helping them to find, things like little sand-dwelling mayflies, little mussels and crayfish, and things like sturgeon chub and sicklefin chub for pallid sturgeon. So their mouth is on the bottom. They've got these really cool barbels, and that's another thing that kind of helps them sense around their environment. That's really more a chemoreception. They're sort of tasting around them. And
Are barbels, I'm going to interrupt you a minute. Are barbels like they look kind of like whiskers on a
that's right.
catfish? Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, you will have to interrupt me because once you just, it's like a top. Once you set me off, it's just going to go, 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 go.
It's
And
quite all right.
it'll be like, trying to drink from a fire hose. There's a lot of information to kick out in a short amount of time.
Okay.
But yes, they look like little whiskers. That's right. And they are full of just little nerve endings that help them, sense their environment. And with a shovel nose and a pallid sturgeon, really, those are two species that look very, very similar. They're both in the genus Scaphorhynchus. There are a total of three members in the world in that genus. It's
Wow.
Alabama sturgeon, which is incredibly endangered, down in kind of the very specific drainages in Alabama, and I think maybe even in Mississippi or Florida. Don't quote me on that one, but with shovelnose and pallid sturgeon, shovelnose is certainly the most common of those three species, and then pallid sturgeon is another really rare fish. Between those two, you flip them over, you look at their rostrum. Pallid sturgeon have barbels, positioned in a way that their most outside barbels are a little bit posterior, so closer towards the tail. The inside barbels are a little bit more anterior, so closer towards the kind of tip of the snout. And a shovelnose sturgeon is going to have, kind of the insertion point for all those barbels sort of straight across, and those barbels will be all four kind of the same length, whereas a pallid, a little bit longer on the outside, shorter on the inside. Yeah, they've got, they're just very bizarre looking. If you ever catch a sturgeon, they're just striking because they don't look like anything else. They've, got this big rostrum. They got these tiny little beady eyes. They've got little sensory, pores all around their rostrum, and then they're covered with really sharp scutes. So they don't have scales per se, but they've got these armor-like scutes that will, go down the sides of their body, down the top of their body, and then on kind of the edges of their belly there. But otherwise, they've got, two pectoral fins, two pelvic fins, an anal fin, a dorsal fin, and a caudal fin. So they're a basic fish.
And we're talking about the pallid sturgeon and the paddle nose or paddle sturgeon?
So there's pallid sturgeon and then
Pallid.
shovelnose sturgeon. Those are
And
two really closely related
okay.
ones.
And do both of those, is there something unique about those species or their place in the ecological environment?
Yeah, they are built for a big, turbid, sandy bottom, muddy river. The Missouri River, the Big Muddy, used to look, a little bit different than maybe it does today. We've done a lot to that river to make it, function for humans, and have changed it, in ways that might not be compatible with some of these fish species. But historically, it was a very muddy, a lot of sediment. shifting sand bottoms, turbid river. And turbidity is just kind of, how much light can get through that water. So the more mud, sediment, silt that's in the water column, the more turbid it is. And sometimes, that river used to look very, very muddy. And that's just how pallid sturgeon like it. So if you can kind of, envision what a fish like that is seeing underwater, it's not, like a trout species that's really using their eyes to forage. Really, it's lights out. They're not probably seeing too much. So they don't have a whole lot of investment in their eyes. They've got really small eyes. But what they do have is, a large set of nares, which is essentially another way for them to taste the water. They've got this really big rostrum, and that helps them to kind of, pick up on some of those minute electro impulses from, other fishes. And then they've got those barbels to help them taste, their environment. So they are incredible fish that are able to navigate these huge rivers with, amazing accuracy and getting to where they need to go.
Are they both threatened or are they endangered? I can't remember.
Good. Yeah, I'm sorry. I probably glossed over that. So pallid sturgeon are endangered. Shovel-nose sturgeon are not necessarily listed. They are included under a what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service calls a similarity of appearances clause, and that is, they look so much alike that in order to protect pallid sturgeon, they really want to protect both species.
Oh, interesting. And if they were to disappear from the environment, then how would that affect the river and the other things around it?
Yeah, so that's oftentimes a question that we'll get. And with pallid sturgeon, I don't often use the term keystone species, in that things might not necessarily fall to pieces without them, but that is a huge cog, in this working Missouri River Basin environment. And without them, you will really see changes in what that fish assemblage looks like, because these are a super long-lived fish species. And I'll get into kind of what their lifespan looks like in a minute, but a very long-lived fish. They are the top predator in the river. And once those little baby sturgeon reach, a foot or so, there's not a whole lot that can eat them. And so they are, pretty tough. They're going to be around for a long, long time, and they will have certainly an impact on shaping what, an aquatic assemblage looks like for, the Missouri River, the Yellowstone River. And yeah, they're incredibly important.
Are the males and females different in appearance?
Not necessarily. We spend a lot of time, working with these fish and boating them, and there are times where we could tell a male from a female, but typically outside of kind of reproductive periods, they don't have any characteristics that, show some sexual dimorphism. So there's really no difference in them per se. But when a mature female is close to spawning, there's a notable difference in kind of the shape of that body, that, some of these really old, mature females can carry, 100,000, 170,000, plus eggs, and can, put on a kilo or two just in, that sort of egg biomass. So they certainly have a big plump belly. Usually those males will be a little bit slimmer, but yeah, as far as kind of morphological features or characteristics, there's not a whole lot of difference between male or female.
And could you say something about their lifespan?
Yeah, and I think, the eye-catching part of their lifespan is that these are super old fish. We maybe don't understand just how old they can be. We do know that we have fish that are, 80, 90, maybe 100 years old. We have some really old fish in Montana. In fact, Montana, and into, western North Dakota, we have the oldest pallid sturgeon in the world. And these are fish that live a long time. And have a kind of patience that, many could probably admire, in that They don't have to reproduce successfully every year. They've got time. But for some of these wild fish, that time is all but run out. And we are desperate to find ways to, get some of the genetics captured for pallid sturgeon, knowing that we have a much smaller subset of individuals to, retain that genetic information in the population. And we know that, some of those wild adults might behave differently than some of our sort of hatchery-reared individuals that we've been really successful in propagating in the hatcheries and introducing into the river as, that kind of next generation after these wild fish, inevitably senesce. So the lifespan is really cool. But one thing I did want to, and I don't know if we kind of talked about maybe covered it, but really is their life history. And so they live a really long time. But the interesting aspect about pallid sturgeon is just how migratory they are. And that's really, one of the unique aspects of them, but also, maybe one of the life history components that leaves them to be, in a bad spot and ultimately, in an endangered status for the Fish and Wildlife Service. So these fish require really long stretches of river, upwards of, 200, 300 kilometers in length. And that is for adults to migrate upstream, to successfully reproduce and spawn, and for their larvae to drift downstream and develop. And that's where kind of one of the key components is missing for a lot of pallid sturgeon populations, that they don't have enough drift distance for those larvae to completely develop and ultimately sort of settle out of the drift of the river. Once they're settled out and once they grow, then they're pretty resilient. They once they reach kind of that, maybe foot long length, they are pretty tough little critters and will be around for a long time.
When the young hatch out, do they just look like minnows, or do they look different from most minnows that I'm familiar
So,
with?
Roxanna, you said something that means something to me. So minnows, I'm going to dispel sort of a misnomer, if you will.
Oh, thank
Minnows
you.
are a family of fish,
Oh.
and they are in the family Leuciscidae. There are lots of fish that obviously start small and grow big, and people have always, since I was a kid, referred to essentially all small fish as minnows. But minnows are actually a specific group of fishes that we've got, a number of species in Montana. Sturgeon chub, sicklefin chub, those two I mentioned earlier, those are two species of minnow that are found in the Missouri and Yellowstone rivers. But so back to your point though, when pallid sturgeon are hatch out of their eggs, and I don't know if you've ever had caviar, but those are sturgeon eggs. So little tiny black eggs. Once that egg is fertilized and that larvae starts to develop, it'll look a little more salt and pepper. There'll be some gray and white to the black. They will hatch out and just look like a tiny little globule with a tail. And then as they, work their way through that yolk sac and develop, they'll start looking like a tiny little sturgeon, a week into development. And then, from there, each day they start to look more and more like a sturgeon. And then after about, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, they are, a tiny version of their adult self. But
Wow.
when they're little, they are neutrally buoyant, maybe, slightly negatively buoyant. And they are just at the whim of the river. And so they are drifting downstream. And where that current goes is where they're going to go. As they, kind of develop little tails, they'll start to, show some more volition and kind of where they want to go. But for the most part, they're just drifting. And then when they finally kind of develop into a little sturgeon, that's when they will be, a little bit more benthically oriented. They'll be on the bottom and they'll be doing things that sturgeon do.
That makes me think of one other question. What kind of conditions do they need to spawn successfully?
Yeah, great. Really, we've done a lot of work over the years, decades, in order to kind of answer that question. And a lot of it has to do with the timing and the magnitude of flows. So with that, you've got, fish species that, maybe can reproduce in a lot of different habitats, might be cued by a lot of different environmental factors, but with sturgeon, it's pretty specific. So, those adults are looking to the environment and the flows to get that cue to move upstream. And what is really important is that, long stretch of connected river. And so with those flows, they will be attracted upstream, and they will kind of wait for other adults to show up. There'll be kind of a period of time where they're, really waiting for those eggs to fully mature. They're waiting for, males to show up and to look for, bits of habitat that have kind of a soft, sandy bottom, that are kind of found in certain bends of the river. And once they've kind of found each other and figure out where they're going to spawn, that reproduction, that successful reproduction, starts the clock on kind of that drift and development of eggs. So it takes a few days for those eggs to kind of, be fertilized, sit and hatch out. And then once those larvae are hatched out, they're off to the races and drifting downstream.
Neat. And historically, do we know where these species lived, and has that changed over time?
Yeah, so historically, pallid sturgeon were likely found all the way up to the Great Falls, and that Fort Benton down from Fort Benton up to where the Great Falls are, all the way down, to the Gulf of Mexico, essentially. They were
Wow.
probably far more abundant in the Missouri River proper, but we certainly do know that those fish were found, in the Mississippi River, and on down to the Gulf. However, it's been noted that they really did prefer the Missouri River, and there was something about the Missouri River that was attractive to pallid sturgeon. They've never been, a super abundant fish, certainly not as abundant as shovelnose sturgeon, but yeah, because of that, ability to migrate and move upstream and live a long time, they've been able to spread out, all the way from the Gulf up to, the Great Falls.
Do you know, like, when they were first counted or kept track of in Montana?
Yeah, so I believe so. The first sort of documented occurrence of pallid sturgeon in Montana was 1876, and but that was a giant head of a pallid sturgeon that was found
Oh,
there
my.
at Fort Benton, and I think at the time they thought that was a large shovelnose sturgeon. It really wasn't until a paper came out describing pallid sturgeon as a distinct species from shovelnose sturgeon in 1905. And that was based on an individual that was captured just up from the Missouri River. You have the Mississippi, the Illinois, and then the Missouri River kind of coming together, and just kind of outside of St. Louis. And that was where the individual that was used to describe pallid sturgeon came from. So not quite as long as other species, but that kind of owes to its nature of being, fairly reclusive. The Missouri River is not an easy place to necessarily, see fish or catch fish. Once it gets down there to St. Louis, it's a big river. And once it gets to Culbertson, Montana, it's a big river.
Thank you so much, Zach. We are going to continue that interview in a coming show, hopefully next week. He is just full of so much information. My thanks today to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio, to Zach Shattuck and FWP, and to the good folks at KGBM who make space for this show. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Sounds today came from my backyard and from the Missouri Headwaters State Park. I would love to hear from you, so please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is still 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams.